Thank you for the invitation. It's really exciting to talk to all of you today. And yeah, actually, what I'm going to do with this seminar is to give you a kind of a broad view of how we as physicists try to answer questions in ecology. And I'm going to establish this relationship in two directions, actually. First, of course, we are going to see how we as physicists can help developing ecology and formalizing ecology, but also we'll see how that relationship can also be inverted and how we can establish kind of a one-to-one relation between both disciplines. And I know many of you, or probably none of you, has these works on these topics, has these ideas of how ecology and physics can be related to each other. And this was actually something quite weird to me in the beginning also when I started working on these topics. So this is the first question I had, and probably we all have when we face a field that is so far away from what we are used, and we see that it can somehow use with our background. No? So this question of why physics and ecology can be good friends, or how can they partner each other, is even more striking, or at least was to me, because ecology looks like this messy science where we have all these guys back in the last cent or two centuries ago, that they were going to the field, they were spending 2 weeks watching butterflies moving around, watching flowers, taking notes and describing it. No, we have this idea of ecology close to natural history, which is a much more descriptive science than quantitative or manipulative. No, they didn't try to manipulate these systems and understand them. They were just watching them and outreaching what they were seeing. But of course, things developed, and people around 100 years ago, more or less, they started developing this idea that whenever they were observing nature, when they were observing, I don't know, how these butterflies were moving, or how a population of flowers was growing in the backyard, for instance, they were actually observing a pattern. They were observing something that was repeating in very different places. And that pattern had behind some dynamical process. So this idea between this connection between ecological pattern and dynamical process is what somehow triggered the development of ecology towards a more quantitative science. So I'm talking about, I don't know, butterflies, flowers, plants, but what really set up this connection was a series of experiments that were done actually with microorganisms, with very, very tiny organisms. And these experiments were basically very simple setups. I want you to imagine that you have a flask, you have some bottle with a lot of water and sugar, and you put inside some yeast. So yeast is something that we all like a lot because it's responsible for bread, wine, beer. So it's a very, very important to understand organism. And these people, what they were doing was basically they were growing these yeasts on a bottle, and they were monitoring through time how the number of cells, or how the population of cells was growing. And this was kind of the very, very simple pattern that they were observing. They were seeing that for a while, nothing was kind of happening. There was very, very small population sizes, so nothing was kind of measurable. But eventually these numbers started to grow, kind of, I don't know, here it seems linearly, and eventually this growth stopped and the number of cells established in a fixed size. So this is one example on a very small scale, experiments that people were able to do in their labs. But these patterns also repeat in much larger scales. So this is actually data from Canada. People were monitoring for many years the number of rabbits, of hares, which is a prey, and the number of lynx, which is a predator, that were inhabiting in some region. So when they were making these numbers, when they were making their estimations, counting basically the number of individuals, they found this very interesting oscillatory pattern. Kind of noisy, of course. Everything in biology is extremely noisy. But still some information behind it, right? We see these oscillations. We see that the phase is kind of, the blue peaks are always before the red peaks. So I don't know, there are some features there that maybe we can try to formalize. This was one of the things that were going around the mind of these people when they were observing this phenomenon. And again, this story repeated many times. Now this is another experiment, very similar to the one with yeast, but with paramecium, which is a much less interesting organism because it's not responsible for any good. So here what people were doing was growing two different species of this paramecia in different bottles. And they observed that they both, okay, kind of grow the same in the same way. Notice that the scale is different. So the, let's call these guys the green cells, were growing much larger numbers. The purple ones were reaching smaller numbers. So, okay, there is some different behavior here in the growth, but my pattern, this growth followed by saturation, is more or less the same. And then people started saying, okay, now what's happening if we mix both and allow them to grow together? And what they found is that actually when they grow together, one goes to this kind of same stable regime, but the other one dies. So people started accumulating a lot of observations, but they were observations, no theory behind it. There is no understanding of what's going on in these bottles for this behavior to emerge, no idea of what was going on. And of course, today I'm going to focus on these dynamical processes that happen on time, because I think they are kind of more illustrative of the kind of ideas that we have. But these ecological patterns happen on many other different contexts. I'm just going to take a few slides to show you other examples of ecological patterns that are actually, to me, they are too beautiful for not showing them in one of these seminars. So one of those examples is actually all over us, all around us. It's a pattern that is formed by vegetation itself when it grows with very little water. So for instance, here, this picture that I'm showing you is a picture from Israel in the desert, where as you can see, the grass is forming this kind of intriguing structure in a space where this is not random, not perfectly regular, but there is some order behind these structures. And there are many examples like this. This is another example in Niger in Africa. As you can see, the wavelength, the characteristic length of this pattern is very different, but still the shape is kind of the same. So there is this idea of what's going on here, what are plants doing that allow them to self-organize in these structures at these different scales. And again, they happen all over the place. This one is especially pretty to me. As you can see, this is 10 meters. So this is a very large scale. These are tiny plants that they are organizing these huge structures of several kilometers on the space just by the way that one plant interacts with all. This is a really, really emergent phenomenon. And when you have different properties in the landscape, for instance, here, there is a small slope. You see that this symmetry is kind of broken and we have these stripes that, of course, privilege one of the directions in the system. Other examples that we've worked with, and with these two, I move back to what we are going to focus on. But again, I found this is extremely pretty. What I'm going to show you is a colony of bacteria. Bacteria are tiny, tiny cells that they are growing on a surface. We are giving them food. This is actually an experiment that we did in Princeton. We give them food and we allow them to grow until they cover the whole surface. These bacteria are all identical, but we manipulate them genetically. So one of them is going to bright in red and the other one is going to bright in blue. And the reason why we do this is because we can track the siblings of each cell. Red cells are going to have red siblings and blue cells are going to have blue siblings. So we can study how families of bacteria establish on a surface. And this is the kind of structures that we see. Of course, these structures depend on the number of cells that we put, on the environment in which they grow. There is much more complexity, but I want just to give you some ideas of the kind of processes that I think of when I talk about an ecological pattern. And this is the last one that is especially pretty. This is a population of cells that eventually, because they don't have food, they will start talking to each other through the secretion of chemicals, and they will do what you are about to see. They will synchronize their internal states, and eventually they all go towards the same place. They establish these amazing streams of cells, and they all decide to form multicellular aggregates. So these processes are way more complex than the growth of yeast in a bottle, of course, but they are very important also from a biological point of view. So for instance, this pattern of bacteria that I was discussing in the beginning is made by cholera bacteria. And cholera is a really, really bad bacteria for humans. And it grows, if it grows in our bodies, it can kill us in a matter of days. So it's very important to understand how it grows these structures to be able to maybe break them and manage these infections. So again, I'm going to focus more on the physics part, on how we address this from a mathematical point of view, but I will touch a little bit also on what biology we can learn from all this physics and all this mathematical approach. So, okay, now we have all kind of this broad overview of patterns. And now the question is, why I always establish this connection between ecology and statistical mechanics? What's behind these patterns? What's the key idea that allow us to use physics, to use especially statistical physics, to understand these processes? And the reason to do that is basically that these macroscopic patterns do not depend on the microscopic processes that happen, that underlie them. So let me explain this sentence because it's too much of a statement to begin with. But the idea is that basically it doesn't matter a lot what's going on in this bottle. Yes, we have a question.
Yes, statistical mechanics is one way to address this, but there's also the Turing model. That's using partial differential equations, which also works very successfully.
Yes, so actually, for instance, the vegetation patterns that I was showing, they are Turing patterns.
Yes.
And we study them using Turing theory to model how water interacts with vegetation.
Right, so this is so mechanics.
No, it is not. What I'm going to focus today, it's on a collection of particles that are living on a flask and they interact with each other. And we develop these models for the macroscopic pattern based on ideas from statistical mechanics. But I'm not going to be talking about partitioning functions or Gibbs energy or concepts from statistical mechanics. We use the mathematical formalism that people use to do this connection between microscopic processes and macroscopic descriptions to develop models for understand these ecological patterns.
Go ahead. Okay, thank you.
Okay. And actually, these models, these Turing models, when we modify them, sometimes we introduce some microscopic reactions and we also try to extrapolate them to macroscopic scales. But yes, I'm not going to be talking about statistical mechanics today. So yeah, the idea to use this, to translate this mathematical formalism from statistical mechanics to ecology is this idea that the patterns somehow they have some features that do not depend on the microscopic dynamics. So here, of course, something is happening in the bottle. These cells are doing something, and probably yeast does these things in a different way. Differently to how Paramecia do them, but somehow they establish a macroscopic pattern that has some features, and this is the key idea. And this, of course, when people started developing these models, they were thinking about how statistical mechanics develops equations for macroscopic properties by taking statistical ensembles and doing statistical approximations to the microscopic processes that are happening in those systems. So with this idea behind, they got to develop quantitative models, they got to develop equations, models that were explaining these macroscopic patterns. So for instance, for the very simple case of this yeast growing in a bottle, what they developed was one of the most well-known models in population ecology, which is called the logistic model, that was basically given how the number of cells in that bottle was changing in time. This is the time derivative of the number of cells as a function of two processes. So they were assuming that in very short time scales, when n is very small, all this is going to be driven by an exponential growth, which is given by this first term. But eventually, as this population grows, there is more interaction between cells, there is more competition between cells for the remaining resources. And then this quadratic term is going to be the responsible for this saturation in the growth. So of course, depending on how you parameterize this model, you get different specific shapes for this pattern. But the general idea is that these patterns are going to depend on the species, they are going to depend on the tiny details, but the macroscopic pattern within some range, of course, is going to be robust to changes in those parameters. And of course, more complex situations, although this one is maybe not especially complicated, but they can be also explained with these ideas. So what I'm showing you here in this low part of the slide is the model that tries to explain the dynamics of these two populations. And as you can see, basically, it's very similar to the one above, but the only idea is that now the interaction term is a cross interaction term. So N1 interacts with N2 in a way that it inhibits the growth of N1. So N1 are the rabbits, and it enhances the growth of N2, which are the lynxes. And in the absence of species one, species two dies because it doesn't have food. And in the absence of species two, species one grows exponentially because it doesn't have anyone feeding on it. And again, the dynamics of this model, of course, we have more equations. We have here two equations. So the outcome is richer. We may have dissociations, we may have no oscillations, but within this parameter space, we can recover not only the oscillation, but also the proper phase between the peaks of the one population and the peaks of the other. So this is the more or less the kind of historical overview of how people are starting from watching phenomena, either in the laboratories or outside in the field, they started thinking about writing equations to explain these processes. Of course, these equations may be much more complex, as for instance, Turing equations for explaining these patterns that I was showing you, or the equations that we wrote to explain this aggregation phenomena are way more complex than these equations. But my point today is that even in this very, very simple model that have more than 100 years, there is a lot of physics to do, and there is a lot of things to improve them and get them closer to reality. And that's what I want to talk for the rest of the seminar. So the main idea to develop, to refine these models is that population dynamics is an emergent phenomenon, as I've been claiming since the very beginning. So these lines that we observe, and many people explain them writing equations because you know that a quadratic term in my ODE is going to saturate the growth and a linear term is going to grow, and I can do this phenomenological way of writing the models, they can also be written starting from a more mechanistic description. They can be written by starting from how these cells are interacting with each other. And this is what we try to do here, what we do here. We imagine this population of cells. We have this macroscopic pattern that we've already discussed. And what we do is we go to the very, very microscopic dynamics. And we write stochastic models to explain that dynamics. So for this specific example, the way we will approach this problem would be by proposing that these cells are actually dividing. When they have food, one cell splits and gives rise to two cells. And that happens at a rate beta. Every time step, every unit of time, I have a probability per unit time beta of these cells splitting and giving rise to two cells. Of course, they can also die for external stresses or because they don't have food, they can die. And that happens at a different rate that I will call delta. And eventually they can also kind of find each other when there is, for instance, a piece of sugar for many cells. Two cells may find each other in that piece of cell, in that piece of sugar, and then one is going to die and only one is going to survive. And that would be described by this biological reaction. So of course we can simulate this just with a computer. We can simulate these stochastic events and we can get a tracking of how the population size is changing. We can also write a master equation for the number of cells in my system. That in principle for many of the systems is going to be very, very hard to solve. And we can work with approximations to that master equation to get an idea of how this process is happening, considering also fluctuations. We can, for instance, write the Fokker-Planck equation for this stochastic process, or we can take the deterministic limit, which in this case would converge to the nonlinear differential equation that I was showing you in the beginning. So at this point, we have kind of two paths that get to the same point. And for this specific problem, maybe for many of us, it's kind of wasting time to start from the very, very microscopic point and go to the macroscopic one, while I could postulate some equation for the number of cells, and that's it. It's an ODE. I can solve it analytically. I think it's not a very big deal to pose it by hand-waving arguments even. But the point is that by developing this approach, I have full control of the origin of each of the terms. And I can manipulate my microscopic processes on a more realistic way, and I can work all the way to see how that reflects on the macroscopic equation. And when things get more complex, more complicated, that's not so easy to do from the scratch. So for instance, one assumption that is extremely strong and the one that I'm going to discuss today with you is this idea that whenever two cells encounter with each other, one of them is going to die and the other one is going to survive. So as you can see, what this assumption, I mean, the reason why this assumption is translating into this quadratic term is basically because here I'm assuming that my cells are all over the place. They are moving like an ideal gas in my bottle. They are covering all the space homogeneously, and they only interact when they find each other, when they collide with each other. Of course, by assuming this, the interaction term is going to be given by the number of pairs that I can make from that population, which in the limit of n large gives us this n squared term. But that's a huge assumption. And that's where this idea that the microscopic properties don't affect the macroscopic pattern breaks. And this is basically where we are working now. We are working on different scenarios in which this assumption breaks down, and we try to develop refined microscopic models and go all the way up to the macroscopic equations to see if we can make predictions about that ecological system in particular. So, as I was saying, the idea behind this quadratic term for the interactions, this well-mixed assumption, is basically that cells, animals, all the members of my population, wherever they are, they behave as an ideal gas. By that, what I mean is that the assumptions that I make about the way they move is that they either move in ballistic trajectories and they only change directions when they find the borders of the container, or equivalently, I can work the way and show that if I assume that the movement is just random, not ballistic and rebounding, but some Brownian motion within the flask, the term that I get from interaction is the same. So basically, written in equations, what these models assume for the movement of the particles is that they undergo a Brownian motion. Of course, the problem of this Brownian motion is that in the stationary state, the distribution of the positions would not reach a stationary state. It would diverge. The variance of this distribution would diverge in the stationary state. So I need to contain them. I need to define a range. I need to define a container where my particles are going to be, where my population is going to be. I don't know. It can be an island, or it can be an imaginary limit that I put in the region that I'm studying, the bottle. I need to define a boundary for my particles. And as we'll see in a minute, that can bring some, not complications maybe, but unrealistic results. So in this very simple condition, in the stationary state, provided that this boundary is smooth enough and behaves, doesn't have like any non-smooth properties in the borders, the distribution for the position of one particle is a uniform distribution. So it's equally likely to be found in every point of this, in this case of this disk. So here in gray, I'm showing you an example of a trajectory of this Brownian particle over space. If I move it longer, it will cover the whole space. So of course, this, as I was saying, this assumption breaks in many scenarios. I'm going to discuss with you one today with a little bit more of depth, and one a little bit more not so much in depth, basically. So this is the main question that we try to answer in all our projects. So how do complex microscopic properties of this system translate into macroscopic dynamics? So how this micro-macro connection is going to be done in different systems? So one of the projects that we are working on that is led by Vivian, who is a postdoc here in the ICTP, is to understand how these dynamics, population dynamic changes when these organisms live in a flow environment. What happens when there is some mixing that is actually driving the dynamics and the movement of these particles? This is a very interesting question from the point of view of marine ecology, or how what happens with ecological systems in rivers, in general, in systems that live in any flow environment. So as you can see in this movie, here I have particles that are going to be advected by a chaotic flow, which is a model for turbulent mixing. And as you can see, at some point, this is far away from being well mixed. So the flow is going to create structures in the space where particles are going to be trapped for a very long time. Those regions in space can work as a hotspot for biological activity. For instance, my particles are trapped for a very long time there, and then these structures break, particles disperse to the environment, and we have kind of a non-stationary or very long transient regime in which these systems may do things that are very, very different to what we're used to. We are working on this. We don't have many to discuss or to show yet, but I'm very hopeful to have something soon. At least we have nice movies. Anyway, the other example which we've developed further, and it's actually easier, or the math to work is easier to discuss, is what happens with animals that live on a flat on the earth, on a landscape. How do they move? No? And what we can answer that question now, because there is a lot of technology that allows us to study how these individuals move in space. We can go to the field and we can put a GPS tracking system. And then we collect this data and we can see how animals move over long times. We can see how much or how less mixed they are. So when we observe this data that we now have, we find things like that. So what I'm going to show you now in this movie is the GPS collected trajectories of a group of wolves in Minnesota. And we'll see what happens. We are going to see, I think, 6 wolves. This is over time. We see how they are moving. The region is very flat. It's pretty flat. There is not any natural boundary limiting the way they move. And as you can see, I think it's pretty clear at this point, this is anything but well mixed. Actually, it's these guys, it's something that we know from the natural history studies on the species. These guys don't like finding each other. I mean, they form groups, they form wolf packs. Within each pack, they are social, they interact within packs. But when a wolf pack finds another wolf pack, they are very, very territorial. They try to establish territories, and they don't like finding known friends in their territory. So
a quick question, how big are those regions?
The home ranges?
Yeah,
the regions, they depend a lot on the species. I think for the case of the wolf, it's a few hundred kilometers, if I'm correct. But I will show an example in a few slides of monkeys that is a few meters. So it really depends on the species.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. So, okay, this is the starting point for the rest of the discussion. We have this movie, or this kind of movies. I will show you many more. You will see that this happens in many, many species. And well-mixed assumptions do not work. So then the question is, how this microscopic segregation in space is going to affect the dynamics of these populations? And the way we approach this problem is actually taking a very physicist approach. That's why I prefer to discuss this project with you rather than the roots ones that Lathan was mentioning in the beginning. Of course, we started with n equal to 2 because, I was doing the calculations, so n equal to 2, I thought it was enough to begin with. And we assumed that these guys, instead of moving all over the place, performing a Brownian motion, they were doing a Brownian motion that was trapped in a harmonical potential, in a harmonic potential. So what I want you to think of now is that instead of having this container with reflecting boundary conditions, I have an infinite space. I don't need any reflecting boundary, but now I have potential harmonics that are going to be centered in the center of these territories. And each animal is going to fluctuate. It's going to do some random movement within each potential, but it's going to be always drift towards their home, basically. So this is a model that actually we didn't develop that. It's an Olsen-Uhlenbeck process. For those of you that are more familiar with stochastic processes, it's been used for many years to model animal movement, and it's quite accurate to reproduce the behavior of these species. However, what we need now to be able to use these models to infer macroscopic scale processes is an expression we need to work out how these models predict that these encounters happen. So in other words, how do these harmonical potentials change this n square interaction term, basically? Because now I don't have these pairs anymore. Now, as you can see in this snapshot, the blue guy is not going to find the red one unless, I don't know, unless some long excursion happens. So this n square approach, approximation for sure is not working anymore. And after that, I mean, once we have this expression for the pairwise interactions, we can use the formalism from statistical mechanics. We can use master equations. We can use a Fokker-Planck equation to describe the population with more than two individuals. So this is the general route towards the way we are going to approach this problem. So as you can see from this scheme, the building block of this work is basically understanding how these two individuals find each other. And this is a building block on any biological theory for interacting populations or for interacting entities or for whenever you have guys that are finding each other. It happens, for instance, yes.
Yes, are you looking for scaling relations between, say, the size?
For, sorry?
Scaling relations between, say, the size of the animal and the size of the home territory.
So we have the territory sizes emerge from the parameterization of the movement model freely, but there are indeed scaling laws that connect the size of the territory with the size of the animal.
Great.
So for instance, I don't know, there are animals that need, I mean, it depends on the size, but it also depends on the kind of food that they need. For instance, if they need a very specific type of grass, they may need to track it through the year, and they will be migratory species, whereas animals with the same size that are more flexible in their diets, they can have smaller territories. We don't look at that, but there is a scaling relationships between size and territories and size of the animals. So again, I'm going to discuss this. Probably I'm going to use or abuse language, and I will always speak about a prey and a predator, because just of a matter of language. But these encounter rates are all over the place in ecological interactions. So they happen in competition. An example of ecological competition is, for instance, these vultures and these hyenas that are both of them finding each other on some skeleton to try to feed. They compete for the same resource, for the same food. Another example is mating. For instance, here we have these two butterflies that they find each other to mate. The other example, which is the one that I'm going to use just for a matter of speaking, it's predation. So here we have a poor guy that is going to be killed and eaten by this other guy. And a very probably hot topic in which these encounter rates are very important is also disease transmission. So in the context of the pandemics that we have right now, all the measures that go towards social distances and stuff like that, they basically want to limit the encounter rates between us. So they are all over in epidemiological models, ecological models. They are in many, many places. As I said, I'm going to use prey and predator just because I think it's easier, but can be generalized very, very easily. Okay, so as I was saying, we are going to assume, again, that our animals are particles that are trapped in these harmonic potentials. Now this reflects on a stochastic differential equation for the position of each individual in a two-dimensional space. I'm going to work everything in two dimensions that has this Brownian motion that I was saying before. This is just a white noise, a random number without any correlation. And this G over here gives me the intensity of this noise. if you want to say, if you want to establish this mapping, this would be the temperature. It's going to give me how much I'm shaking these particles in the harmonic potential. Again, this is a very non-formal connection. And this is the drift term that is going to drag the animals towards their home range center. It's going to drag, it's the whenever the animals move very far away, they will feel this deterministic force that drives them back home. So what is really nice about this additional deterministic force here is that now this stochastic process is stationary. So if I go to the infinite time limit, my variance does not diverge. It reaches a stationary, a fixed value. So I don't need boundary conditions. I can work everything on an infinite space. And when I want to work the math, the analytical work to find these encounter rates, it's very nice because I don't need to solve these things on bounded environments. I can just use things like Fourier analysis very easily, and I can work in an infinite space in a very straightforward way, let's say. Again, because this is a normal distribution, because this is the only source of stochasticity in my process is this term here. This is normal, which means that my random numbers, I draw them from a normal distribution, from a Gaussian. Then I'm doing a linear transformation to this process, and my whole process C is also a Gaussian process. And because this is a normal, it follows a normal distribution, I can describe my probability density function for the position of the individual, just giving the two first moments of the distribution, which is in this case, the vector of mean values in X and Y and the matrix of covariances. I can calculate them. And in the stationary state, what I find is that my animal has a mean position that is basically the home range center, the center of the territory, or the minimum of the potential. But it has a variance that is given by the inverse of the intensity of the force and the intensity of the fluctuations. So I think this is very intuitive so far. Notice that the cross terms in the covariance matrix are zero because I'm assuming that whatever happens in the x direction does not affect what happens in the y direction. We also work the case. Sorry, yes.
Yes, question. So the size of your harmonic track, shouldn't that also change with time? I mean, if a population gets very successful, they will need to increase the size to support itself. So by assuming that it's fixed, are you not messing up with a true physical process that could take place?
Yes, that's a great question. We are, I'm sorry if this sounds like a standard answer. We are working on that. I have my last slide is actually about that. What we assume is that populations or individuals get very successful when there is reproduction. So far I'm going to work only in the time scale at which I have animals moving and they encounter. If I add up reproduction, then we need to assume something about how these territories grow.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So again, this is more or less how this looks like. This dashed black thick line is basically the equivalent to the R that I had before. Notice that now is not any boundary condition here. There is nothing. It's just for a visual comparison. And my trajectory can actually do excursions away from it. But it's well contained within its territory. So the last thing I'm going to define is this row one that you can see here, that is a size of the territory, an effective size of the territory. It's a characteristic spatial scale for these territories, which I define it in terms of the percentiles of these normal distributions. By convention, people in movement ecology, they use the 95th percentile, but at the end all the results that we get are going to depend on which percentile we get, of course. The point is, be sure that what percentile you choose does not affect your results dramatically, and things work kind of nicely in that regime. Okay, so just the way I work better is by putting things together and comparing both of them. So this is more or less the two movement models that we will be talking about. The one on the right is what we call the reflecting Brownian motion. It's a Brownian motion contained on some disk, and it's going to reflect whenever it reaches the borders. The one on your left is the OU model, where we have this R here, that is also, again, as I was saying, is for comparison so far. And the time scale, the spatial scale that determines the spatial, the space use of this individual is this row one here. So in summary, due to this trapping in harmonic potentials, the OU limits naturally the use of the space for the individual. And it sets, it defines a spatial scale that is much smaller than the spatial scale of the landscape. So imagine that this, because we are physicists, we can say that this disk is an island. I don't know, this is, Cuba. And these OU models limit the way these animals move in Cuba naturally. I don't need to define the borders of the island. And this is going to turn out very, very important, as you can already maybe see from the point of view of interactions between individuals. So key question here, how does this spatial scale influences these encounters? To have encounters, as I was saying, I'm going to work with only with n equal to 2. To have encounters, I need one more than one, n equal to 2 individuals. And this is a typical scenario that mimics the case of the wolves that I was showing you before. So here on the left, I have 2 individuals that they move identically. The parameters of the OU models are the same. And they occupy their territories. And of course, I have an additional characteristic spatial scale that is the distance between the centers of the territories. So this is actually a parameter that can be fixed, fitted very well with data. For instance, for the case of the wolf, this would be very far because they don't like each other. But for other animals, it can be even in the same place if they are very social. That's something that we can access to, we can have access to. Whereas on the other hand, we have these 2 Brownian guys that they basically occupy all the space in the same way, evenly. Good. So now the only thing I have to do is to define an encounter, and then I will move towards showing you how this spatial scale changes these statistics for the encounters. So how am I going to define these encounters? I'm going to take a very simple definition. I'm going to assume that I have here my gray guy, which is going to be the predator. And I have the blue that is going to be my prey. They are moving around very happily, and they are always separated by a distance R. I will define a region around the predator, and that region is going to be the perceptual range of the predator, if you want. So it's going to be the range at which the predator is going to be able to catch the other individual. I'm going to define this I'm defining this scale, which is very small, for mathematical convenience. Then I'm going to take it to the limit where it goes to 0. And I'm going to define my encounters as stochastic, as events that happen whenever the distance between prey and predator is smaller than this Q. And they are going to happen with some probability. And this is something that I want to emphasize. Whenever these guys are close enough, I'm not going to assume that they are encountering each other. I'm going to assume that they can potentially encounter each other. Of course, I can take the limit where this encounter actually happens with probability 1, but we are going to take it, for now, we're going to take it as some probability is smaller than 1. So what's key for the calculation is this pairwise distance between individuals, this R. And the problem somehow with this R is that it is not a Gaussian, it's not a normal variable anymore, because both the distance in the x-axis and the distance in the y-axis, they are normal variables because they are the difference between 2 normal variables. But as I take them to the square, as I take the square of the distance in x and the square of the distance in y, they are not normal variables. They follow another distribution. I can work the statistics as well, but they are a little bit more tricky. But okay, it's an inconvenient, it's not a big deal. So I'm not going to give the whole derivation, especially because I think I'm running a little bit behind time. I'm going to show you the geometric idea of how this scale changes things. And if you want, at the end in the questions time, I'm happy to go through details if you want. So the idea is that the encounter rates for the OU models look like this. They depend on the distance between the home range centers with an exponential dependence. So as the territories go more distant to each other, this probability of encountering is going to fall a lot. And it also depends on the other spatial scales. We will go back to that in a while. And then for the reflected Brownian motion, as you can see, things only depend on the size of the population. And actually, this is basically constant, no? So whenever I fit a territory size or an island size, whenever I fix the size of Cuba, then all my animals will be occupying Cuba homogeneously, and then the probability of finding each other is constant. So basically, in this case, I recover the n square rule that I was showing you in the beginning. But in this case, things are a little bit more complicated because I have three spatial scales that are involved. And I want to recall that I have three because I'm already taking Q equal to zero. If I consider this Q, then I have four, and things get a little bit more complicated in terms of parameters. So that's why I define it, because it makes calculations easier, but then I drop it because for the reasoning of the results is not so relevant. Good. So yeah, this is just so for you to have this mental picture and connect these spatial scales. And the take-home message from this influence of the spatial scales is that assuming these well-mixed populations changes results a lot. So what I'm going to show you is I'm going to compare these two encounter rates that I calculated for OU models and for Brownian motion models. I'm going to assume that I have a predator that has this very large territory, the gray one, and I have a prey, which can be, for instance, this would be the lynx and the blue would be the rabbit, that has this tiny blue territory here. I'm going to show you the encounter rate as I shift the center of the territory of the prey through the territory of the predator. As you can see, in all these cases, the capital R that I was showing is the same. It's going to be this gray circle. In this case, it's going to be equal to the territory of the predator. So in principle, the encounter rate for the Brownian motion is constant. In all these cases, if I assume while mixing, the encounter rate is the same. But for the OU model, when the territories are very close to each other, there is a very large probability for them to find each other because the overlap is actually going to happen in the maxima of the Gaussian distribution. But as I move it away from the, as I move the territory of the prey away from the territory of the predator, then this is going to drop and eventually the there is even a change in, from overestimation to underestimation in encounter rates. So, in case these words, I mean, in case this was a little bit wordy, very graphically, what I'm saying is that when R lambda is equal to zero, I have this overlap between territories. So there's a very intense overlap and they can encounter very easily. But as I move the territory of the prey, the overlap is smaller and then the encounter rate is also smaller. On the other case, however, it's going to be always the same because I don't have this small scale to tune. And again, this is the key idea behind this result. We can explore the parameter space, explore different movement behaviors. And what we get is that the influence of neglecting this home range behavior, this trapping in territories, is huge. And it's not only that it is huge, but sometimes it leads to overestimation in encounter rates, and sometimes it leads to underestimation. So I cannot make general statements about, okay, you are overestimating your encounters at 10%, so you just correct for that and you are done. No, it really depends on the micro thing, on the microscopic thing. So this context dependence makes things a little bit harder. So just I'm going to go a little bit faster over this last part because I think I'm really behind time, but this territoriality does not only change the frequency of these encounters. It also changes the location of the encounters. So in this case, as you can see, when I have these two individuals that have their territories, this is connected to Luis's question, they will all only find each other in the overlap of the territories. And of course, on larger scales, there is these very cool ideas of how this border is shifting towards one or towards the other, no? How these invasions are happening. But if I don't have these dynamics, I have encounters all over this border, this barrier. So if I assume that both individuals are moving independently from each other, I can work the math and I can define a heat map for the probability of these encounters to happen, which is very important. This is key. And this is what I want to take the last few minutes to talk about. So if these guys are perfectly overlapping, this region here would be the whole space. But now I can define different regions and I can see how much I can learn from this limitation in space of the encounters. So this is another movie that it's very similar to the wolf ones, but the animal that we are working with now is these white-faced capuchins that I find them very, very pretty. They live in Panama, or at least the population that we were tracking live in Panama. And here you can see that, each color is again a territory of an animal, and the points are the actual position of the animal. So the animal is moving around their territory, all over the place. They find each other at some points, some other times they don't. And yeah. So of course, from this partial overlap between territories, what makes sense is to think that encounters will happen only in the borders between territories. So we can use our theory to limit that region, in space, which is given by this red contour here. And we can also define corridors within that contour that are regions with a lot of activity in terms of encounters between these individuals. And now what this derivation is telling us is allowing us to define regions of the space where we can see how these animals react to other guys. So we can actually see if the animals behave different in this region or than in the other region. We can learn ecology about these monkeys because we are defining regions where these encounters are more likely to be found and regions where they are less likely. So we can look at things as, like, for instance, how do these animals move within the danger or the risky region, or how do they move in the non-risky region? And actually what we find is that inside the risky region, which is the lighter part of this plot, they move much faster on average than outside the risky region. There is this guy, which is a rule-breaking guy that moves faster outside the region. But in general, we see these shifts in the behavior of the animal. And that helps a lot ecologists to manage these populations when they are in danger, to know where they find each other, how they move in every region. This is a very, very important ecological knowledge that we are learning from this physics approach or from these refined models. And finally, another idea, and this is related, I think, also to some of the questions I got in the beginning. Another important effect is how the landscape affects these animals. So for instance, this is another project that another postdoc in the institute is leading, which is basically taking these OU models and account for the effect of sun environment, which we can consider as a time-independent potential with regions of maximum and minimum of potential, defining places that the animal likes more or less. So in this movie here, you have a jaguar that is in Argentina. I'm very happy that I can give this talk to non-Brazilians because I'm showing this population from Argentina. And when you see, what you see is that the animal, in a while, it's going to start moving all over the place. But you see that the river has a lot of influence in how this animal is moving, right? It's, of course, all this, it's not that the animal is swimming, it's a discretization of the trajectory, but you see that it has a nest, no? A region that she's revisiting a lot of times and is doing these excursions, but always very close to the river. So we are hoping to introduce these environmental effects, landscape effects, and see if we can get refined statistics. And just the last thing, that we are working on is what it's called in stochastic processes theory, higher order statistics. We are working out the expressions for the mean encounter time of these animals. So we are turning a little bit the question, instead of asking how likely these animals are to encounter each other, or which is the region in which these animals are more likely to find each other, we are turning to questions more like when and where these two animals are going to find for the first time, which will hopefully allow us to tell things like, are these two guys going to, or is this prey going to eat in the next 3 days? Are these two guys going to mate in the mating season? So this is a very challenging project that is working, Benjamin is a master student in the institute, is working on it. And basically is taking all these encounters and finding which one is the first, which one is more likely to be the first. And this turns out to be a little bit more mathematically challenging than what I thought in the beginning. He's using things like path integrals and renewal analysis to try to find these expressions. But even for physics, I mean, in a pure physical context, these first passage statistics in two-dimensional OU processes are not known so far. So I think this is a very nice project in which we work on new results, both for physics and ecology. And hopefully we get them. And yeah, this is, it's just the last thing, I promise, related to this question of how territory shape, how, what happens if we introduce interactions between animals, basically. So how does the location and the frequency of the encounters changes if you have a pairwise interaction potential? This is very hard to solve if the potential is not linear, which cannot be. So this hopefully will give us an idea of how these territories change as these animals move around. But I don't think I have time for this. Sadly, we don't have any preliminary result for this project, but I think it can be very, very interesting. So with this, I finish almost on time, thanking the foundations that support our research here in Brazil. FAPESP is the public foundation agency from Sao Paulo, the Simons Foundation, and the Serra Pilheira Institute. And thank you all for listening.
All right, thanks for that very interesting talk. So are there any questions first from students? I see Luis has a question. If we hold on just for 1 second, are there any questions from students in the audience?
Yeah, I would like to ask a question.
Yes.
So you showed a model towards the end where you incorporated the landscape, the river, into the model. So I was wondering that can we, for hard to access places like oceans and stuff, looking at those sort of things. So if we can get the statistics behind how the fish move and we see that there are certain places that the fish tend to avoid. So can we fit the model to that and maybe make interesting predictions about some landscape features under the ocean or something like that? Is that possible?
That's not only possible, but that's the key goal of the project. So in these animals, we know that some landscape features they prefer some things. For instance, I don't know, they don't like water, they don't like they like some type of vegetation. So we can get data on that vegetation, and we can incorporate that to construct our potential. As you were saying, they avoid regions where vegetation is, I don't know, there is no grass. Imagine that you have an animal that is living on a very nice landscape and it has a road. We know that she's not going to go to the road because some car can crash her. So we can define a barrier of potential there, for instance, that is going to repel the individual. We can fit that model to the data that we have. And hopefully either we get good agreement or we get bad agreement and try to see if we can learn something about preferences in the space occupation of these animals. So yes, basically what you were saying is what we are trying to do.
Great. Are there any other student questions? If not, Luis, did you want to ask something?
I wonder, so these models, is there an understanding of maybe a class of animals where this you could imagine would apply and which ones would have no chance or little chance? For instance, I'm thinking there's a difference between a jaguar in the jungle and an orca in front of Peninsula de Valdez, where the orca knows there is a supermarket full of seals, so he just has to go and get one. So the probability is one there. So how do you fold in that information? Or is it the idea that these models are for some certain class of animals and one, the R ones are much more difficult to track?
Yes, so the these models are thought for animals that show home range behavior. So there are animals that are very nomadic. For instance, I don't know, animals that live in the, we work with a population of gazelles that live in the Mongolian steppe, which is a huge flat landscape. They are extremely nomadic and these models don't work so well, although in some limits they do. And then going to your second question, where you have this population of orcas that has this huge pound of fish to feed on, this is basically what we want to account for with this potential. So in the case of the orcas, or I don't know because I don't know about orcas, but in the case of animals that know that they have that very nice source of food, what they usually do is they live in some region, they do their stuff, and whenever they want to feed, they go there. They go there, they hunt, and they go back. They do these kind of excursions. So this is very much related to this idea of accounting for behavioral states of the animals. So this is something we are kind of, I wouldn't say done, but good progressing at good pace, where you have these transition rates in the behavioral state of the animal from hungry to fed, no? And whenever you trigger that transition to hungry, then the movement behavior switches to hunting and it goes to that pound and goes back. And of course that that changes the whole story a lot. So I would say that for the case that I discussed today, it works better for cases like these monkeys that I was showing, that they do all their stuff in a given territory and for interactions within the same species. So I was talking about prey and predators, but my intuition is that when you want to fit these to population time series, it's going to work better when you can track, in the case of the monkeys, for instance, how a monkey is going to encounter another monkey.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Lee.
Yes.
Lee, you're muted.
It's very beautiful talk and very beautiful science. But as we're theoretical physicists here, I have a question for you. Are there any general principles behind these kinds of phenomenon, or do you just try to understand, get the whole story, write a differential equation down and solve it?
Yes, so I think I will answer that question in two steps. So first, regarding this part of movement itself, yes, there is, so these models that basically assume that animals are moving trapped in harmonic potentials, they fit the movement behavior of a lot of species. And I have to say that the model that I was using assumes, it neglects the inertia, right, of the Brownian particle trapped in the harmonic potential, if you want. So I'm not giving any differential equation for the velocity. I'm assuming that time scale is very, very small. When you account for that additional time scale, you can fit, there is a paper published last year that fits, I think, the movement behavior of 500 species just with harmonic oscillators with different levels of damping, which I think is, it's very, I don't know, it's, to me it's a very pretty work. So it's kind of finding this principle of space occupation and different movement behaviors across animals. Then going a little bit bigger to this idea of general principles, if I am allowed to take that license and speculate a little bit, which I think this is the right place to do it. One of the things I feel very, very interested about is that this, when you observe these patterns, and I'm not only talking about this time series of population size, but also these vegetation patterns, for instance, they appear in very, very different places. So touring patterns are amazingly common in biology. I would say it's surprisingly common. Spots, labyrinth, this idea is very, very, to me, it's been around my mind for a lot of, since I was in Princeton. And I would say there is, but I don't know which one. So I think there is some kind of activation inhibition, some kind of connection between the scales of activation in these biological populations and the scale of inhibition, or the scale of attraction and the scale of repulsion, that is somehow leading to this ubiquity, that I'm too Spanish to say that word right, ubiquity, ubiquity of these shapes in the patterns. So yeah, I don't know. To me, my big question is why vegetation forms the same patterns I see in the skin of a leopard.
Yes, and I'd add the spiral structure of galaxies and the patterns of radiation from accretion disks in astronomy. There are several examples in astronomy.
So now that you bring that, I mean, I stopped studying astrophysics and high energy physics when I was an undergrad, but when I was working in this project in my postdoc, I think you can see now the movie in the screen of these cells that aggregate. I was talking to a colleague that he was a postdoc in Princeton in astrophysics, and he was telling me that these structures, these kind of streams, were very similar to some structures that he was observing in the surface of, sorry if I say wrong by saying the moon, but I think it was something like that. They call them spider something.
Well, I didn't know about that.
And that was the only example I can bring with astrophysics or...
As a joke, I'm just going to bring up that astronomers also always bring up careful with selection biases.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the question, and then there are applications to human behavior and economic behavior, like the distribution of businesses around a city as the city is growing, or the distribution of different kinds of neighborhoods around a fast growing city, like Sao Paulo.
So I've seen works even trying to use Turing theory to model crime, distribution of crime, and I think it was crime and something else in cities. I think they were working with LA. I have to say, with a little bit of imagination, but at the end, there is so much variability and noise that it's hard to get rid of that. But with some imagination, I would say it's a fair try.
Okay, so then why do you think these work? Is there a principle?
Sorry, again?
Is there a principle that tells us why these work on such a variety of systems?
So to me, what I found very similar across all these systems that we study is that on the large scale, no? Now, I only talk about how two guys find each other. And there is very hard to extrapolate. But when you compare these Turing models in plants or, for instance, when you look into this pattern here and you count how many aggregates each aggregate has, you find that it has 6. Which is the same number of neighbors that a honeycomb has, the same number of neighbors that the territory of the wolves has. So there is a transition from that 6 neighbors structure to the Turing structure. And to me, what I think is that what drives this transition is whether repulsion is dominating. So when you have these guys that really don't want to find each other, they will pack space in an optimal way. And in 2D, this is an hexagonal pattern. And then they have these 6 neighbors, and the regularity is insane. It's amazing. But then, as you allow for some more short range attraction to work, some short range activation, you know, in the context of the Turing principle, then you start mingling around a little bit these hexagonal patterns, and you start allowing for these more still regular but more spread on the space structures. So my intuition is that.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Well, let's see, maybe that makes me wonder about a question of my own. So, I mean, I guess I remember hearing that, for example, if you look at mammals that, you know, by now mammals in the wild are quite a small percentage of the total biomass of mammals on Earth. It's mostly humans and their domesticated mammals. And I wonder what you think are the implications of that trend for sort of ecology and mathematical modeling of it, in the sense that I guess you might wonder whether increasingly things are more dominated by acts of intelligence, like, in, you know, invention of new technology and so forth. And related to that, I mean, I wonder, are there any different you know, you might wonder whether there are different patterns that form in large populations of more intelligent creatures as opposed to large populations of inanimate stuff or very dumb stuff. I just wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, so I'd say that we, and I think almost, I don't know, but most of the research is done with dumb stuff, because, and especially one single cell stuff, because you can manipulate it in the lab and you can do genetics on it. And it's, yeah, it's kind of easier to tackle. And then people try to go big, no? And one of the main things that people are trying to do now is to incorporate cognition and behavior in these models. Of course, that lies far away from what you can do, as I was showing today, no, analytically, and it goes into more machine learning stuff, collecting a lot of data, doing like very complicated modeling. But I know some people that are, for instance, trying to look into, to track very small groups of primates, of baboons, and they are trying to establish the social hierarchies and how that helps them to make some tasks better as compared to other animals that are social but are not so smart. So to me, that's, it's very, very cool. Very cool stuff what they are doing.
Okay, great. Well, so there's been a lot of questions. I think in view of time, let's thank Ricardo one more time for a super interesting talk, and I'll see you next Wednesday.
Thank you very much. Thank you.